Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
September 3rd of an election year.
It's crazy.
It's a weird feeling.
Post Labor Day for an election year?
Yeah.
Doesn't feel like that, but I guess this has simultaneously been the longest election cycle ever and the shortest with Kamala.
I know. So, yeah. Yeah. That's true. I was talking to a British friend who's like, what is the deal with this whole, like, you only pay attention after Labor Day thing? Is that like a...
Yeah.
Is that a real thing? No.
Is that maybe how it used to be, you know?
Yeah, is that how it
is? It's kind of one of those, like, phony things because back in the day, like, that's whenever you pay attention. I don't know.
Oh, I don't get it either. Well, there's a lot going on in the world this week, Ben. We are going to cover some very terrible news out of Gaza. There was a major election victory for the far right in Germany. The arrest of a top-ranking New York State official for allegedly secretly working as a foreign agent for China.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Didn't see that one coming.
This story
was
nuts, yeah.
Twitter is now banned in Brazil. We're going to talk about why people are concerned about a proposed reform to Mexico's judicial system, a frightening attack on an opposition leader and friend of the show named Bobby Wine in Uganda, and then just more terrible news for women in Afghanistan. And then, Ben, you just did our interview.
Yeah, as if we didn't have enough.
To lighten it up.
Yeah, to lighten it up. I talked to Tom Perriello, who's the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, about his efforts to get more humanitarian aid in at some recent talks that the U.S. led in Geneva about the multiplicity of bad actors fighting the war in Sudan and supporting from externally, and about how we can help hopefully generate some more awareness and attention on what is the world's largest humanitarian crisis.
The Economist had like a big cover story or multi-part special on Sudan this week that was really good and worth reading. And I was looking at one of the articles that had a graphic about the scale of the disaster. And it said, if more help doesn't arrive in Sudan soon, it may prove to be the worst famine anywhere in the world since the China's Great Leap Forward in the 1950s and early 60s.
Yeah, those are not the kind of comparisons you want to see in the 2020s.
So you're like, you're reaching for some of the worst famines in recorded history to describe what's happening.
Yeah,
worst, in Sudan right
and
now.
As Tom points out in the interview, like completely man-made
totally
famines,
man-made.
Right? So this
just
is not,
conflict.
Yeah, this is just purely human beings doing things that are bringing about the potential starving to death of millions of people.
Yeah. And so our first topic today is going to be Gaza because of what happened over the weekend. And there's just been a lot of activism around Gaza, understandably so. But I think you and Tom got into the fact that there just needs to be more churn and activity and conversation about what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, if you're purely rooting your interest in where are the highest stakes for the most numbers of people, you know, Sudan, which doesn't get as much attention as Gaza and Ukraine, would easily, you know, be at the top of that list. And so I think that there is some space to generate attention on this.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's turn to Gaza, though, because over the weekend, we had some really awful news. Six Israeli hostages were found executed by Hamas in a Hamas tunnel under Rafah. According to the Israeli military and autopsies performed on the victims, these hostages had been killed just days before they were found. There was a Hamas spokesman quoted in the media later, who said they had Hamas had instructed fighters guarding hostages to execute them if the Israeli military got close enough for a rescue operation. So it's assumed that's what's happened here. Five of the hostages have been taken from the Nova Music Festival on October 7th, including a 23-year-old American Israeli American named Hirsch Goldberg Polin. The sixth hostage was kidnapped from a kibbutz near the border between Israel and Gaza. Listeners probably saw Hirsch's parents' incredibly powerful speech at the Democratic National Convention. If you have not watched it, I suggest you do now. Their son, Hirsch, was quite literally a hero. He was the kid who was hiding in a bomb shelter with some of his friends on October 7th. Hamas fighters started throwing grenades in there. He ran to the grenades, picked them up, started throwing them out. It blew off half of his arm, and these guys still took him captive anyway, and he survived this long. So just an unbelievably brave person. After this horrible news, though, of their execution became public, there have been mass demonstrations in Israel calling on the government to agree to a ceasefire and hostage release deal. Israel's largest trade union called for a general strike that was in place for part of Monday until a court ordered it called off. Israeli authorities believe there are more than 60 living hostages still alive in Gaza, including four American citizens. On Monday, President Biden was asked if Netanyahu is doing enough to secure a hostage deal. He said no, and you kind of like typical curt Biden press availability format. I don't know why he does that.
No.
Just really short answers to complicated questions.
They think it's, you know, tough or something, I mean, we'll get into why it's not.
Drives me crazy. Yep. Axios reported Biden is considering whether to present both sides with what's been described as a final deal. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but like kind of a take it or leave it best offer from the Americans. I don't know. The latest sticking point in the talks has
I thought it was an Israeli proposal though, Tommy.
Yeah, well, I did too. The latest sticking point has been that Netanyahu has started like late in the negotiations demanding that the Israeli military can occupy the border region between Gaza and Egypt indefinitely. That's been a non-starter for Hamas, and I think for the Egyptians too. So at a press conference over the weekend, Netanyahu was asked about Biden's comments. He responded angrily. Here's a clip.
These murderers executed six of our hostages. They shot them in the back of the head. That's what's changed. And now after this, we're asked to show seriousness? We're asked to make concessions? What message does this send Hamas? It says, kill more hostages, murder more hostages, you'll get more concessions. The pressure internationally must be directed at these killers, at Hamas, not at Israel. We say yes, they say no all the time, but they also murdered these people. And now we need maximum pressure on Hamas. I don't believe that either President Biden or anyone serious about achieving peace and achieving the release would seriously ask Israel to make these concessions. We've already made them.
Okay, so
that is such an utter crock of shit. I'll give you a longer analysis in a second here.
Your reaction was my reaction, which is the cynicism of him getting self-righteous in this moment is almost too much for me to listen to. So sorry for the long windup there, Ben. There's a lot to cover. I think we should start with the obvious, which is like Hamas is responsible for murdering these people. Period. Like they're a brutal, evil terrorist organization. And I hope the people that did it like meet justice in a similar fashion. Well, in a not extrajudicial fashion, but in meet justice. They're also holding, just a reminder, they're holding a one-year-old baby and an 86-year-old grandfather, right? So there's just no justifying this, no anti-colonial argument or argument about, you know, the brutality of the occupation justifies doing that to civilians.
No, and it's not even, in no world is it legitimate resistance to just, you know, shoot civilians in the head.
Massacre kids at a music festival. But what is also true is that Bibi Netanyahu is blocking a ceasefire and hostage release deal. His negotiators want a deal. All the professionals in the national security world want a deal. The Israeli public and the hostage families want a deal. It is Netanyahu that is blocking it. And even though Joe Biden said no when asked if Netanyahu is doing enough, he and his team are giving Netanyahu cover by constantly saying that Israel has agreed to this peace plan they put forward and that only Hamas is the holdup. And we just know that is not true.
It's bullshit. And I mean, just to take the Netanyahu piece of this first, he has relentlessly undermined these ceasefire talks. And again, that doesn't absolve Hamas of any of the responsibility for any of the things they're doing. But the reality is that we know from months and months and months of reporting what the actual deal is on the table that could get done and could get those hostages released. And Netanyahu is the one who kind of keeps moving the goalpost on that deal. And he's really been leaning into this Israeli control of this corridor, I think in part because he knows it's a poison pill. It kills the deal, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a legitimate security argument he could make that they want to control this area to prevent Hamas from smuggling stuff from Egypt into Gaza via tunnels. And they think, I guess, with the permanent occupation in what is currently a demilitarized area, you could do that. But we should point out that his own security team says, you know what, we can mitigate that risk if we pull out of the Philadelphia corridor.
That's the key, right? His own military leadership is supportive of the deal that Netanyahu keeps killing, right? So the people who actually know what they're talking about when it comes to security issues, you know, Netanyahu is not some general, believe that this can be addressed and the hostages can be released. And let's also just name the obvious fact that Netanyahu wants to extend the war because it extends his term in government and out of prison, which is where he'd be if he was no longer prime minister with immunity afforded to him. He doesn't want to give Joe Biden a ceasefire, you know, because probably he wants Donald Trump to win the election. Not probably. I'm sure he wants Donald Trump to win the election. So, you know, this, you know, the perception of chaos and the kind of polarizing nature of what they're doing in Gaza, you know, is somehow good politics for him at home and in the U.S. And when he says that, you know, the pressure, you know, how dare they put aside the fact that he's like, we can't do a ceasefire after six people were killed. I mean, the Palestinians are being asked to do a ceasefire after 40,000 of them
at least
been killed. Yeah. So that doesn't make much sense either. But also the families are the ones that have been pressing him. The families of the hostages are the ones who are telling us, and have been for months, that he's not paying attention to their concerns, that he doesn't care about their family. Even if you listen to him, it's about him. It's not even really about the hostages. You know, he has that in common with Trump. Everything kind of runs back to himself. And what is so frustrating about this in terms of American policy is this is the most predictable thing in the world. You know, like, how many times have we sat on this podcast and talked about how Netanyahu is not a good faith actor? And when you have a strategy to hug the guy from the beginning of the war and you run political interference for him, which is what, you know, yeah, it's always Hamas's fault. There's an Israeli proposal. There's not an Israeli proposal.
And by the way,
the Prime Minister of Israel doesn't agree to it.
He quoted Tony Blinken. He quoted other U.S. Yeah. officials to throw their words in Biden's face in that press conference we just played you that clip from.
Yeah. So, I mean, when Biden says no, he's not doing enough, then the question is, okay, what are you prepared to do about it? Because if you're not willing to actually impose conditions on military assistance to Israel, if you're not even willing to enforce U.S. laws about cutting off assistance to units that engage in human rights violations, why would Netanyahu listen to you when you stand there and say, no, he has not done enough? And then the last thing I just want to say to tee this off, Tommy, and I know you've got thoughts on this too, is it's amazing to me when something like this happens, horrific, horrific killing of these six hostages. And the U.S., the discourse is, you know, obviously about the tragedy, but then it's a kind of about, you know, how hard hitting we can be in our rhetoric on Hamas and you know, very soft pedaled, you know, references to Netanyahu having political problems. In Israel, they have no such restraint. In Israel, there are hundreds of thousands of people protesting, saying it's Netanyahu's fault that these hostages are dead. A discourse that is unimaginable in American politics and media on this issue. I always get whiplash about that, you know?
I do too. The U.S. press coverage of this whole issue has got to get better. Like, the Israeli people and the press blame Netanyahu. They're very clear-eyed about it. They're like, the blood is on his hands. But if you look at comments from American officials or the press corps, it's like a different planet. Like, that, you pick up Politico playbook over the weekend, which we used to make fun of a lot here. I actually think it's really good these days, and I don't mean to pick on them, but the coverage on Monday drove me crazy. So, like, they note the protests in Israel. They note the people who are pushing, they're blaming Netanyahu, but then they frame it as a political problem for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz because of a Breitbart headline, an Eric Erickson tweet, and then a statement from Donald Trump suggesting the U.S. has not done enough to back Israel. Everyone knows the reality is Joe Biden has given Bibi Netanyahu literally everything he wants and has asked for.
Yeah, what does this have to do with what's actually happening in Gaza? I mean, the perceptions in the U.S. tend to be, you know, when Netanyahu comes and gives a speech to Congress, it's all about, like, what does this mean for the politics of the United States? What does this mean for the Democratic Party? Are they going to be in disarray over this issue, right? Or there's this kind of Potemkin, you know, focus on the ceasefire talks as if the entire conflict can be summed up around some, like, readouts from a negotiation in whatever Middle Eastern capital that's like the 900th version of the same negotiation that's been going on for months. Or there's, like, breathless reporting on Joe Biden predicting an imminent ceasefire. When over the last several months, things have gotten a lot worse in Gaza. Things have gotten worse in the regional escalation. You would think actually things have gotten better by the way in which the U.S. press attention has shifted to just the politics of the issue and, you know, the back and forth of ceasefire negotiations. It really is just amazing to me, like, how much there's an unwillingness to kind of wrap your head around just how bad the situation is for the hostages, for the Palestinian people in Gaza, for the future of any potential peace, for regional escalation. And it's because of this, you know, policy of Netanyahu's to kind of constantly perpetuate and escalate things. It's because obviously Hamas is bad actors, and it's because Joe Biden is unwilling to use any leverage whatsoever. Back in the spring, we at least had conversations about whether he'd cut off one weapons shipment. You don't even hear about that
anymore. It's almost a year since the October 7th attacks. The U.S. policy has not changed at all.
Yeah.
At all. There was a conversation about one shipment of 2,000-pound bombs several months ago. Otherwise, it's unchanged. There are the ceasefire talks, which are constant. And, like, I don't doubt that the people working on those talks are working very hard.
Of course they are. And I don't doubt that they desperately want a deal. I'm sure they do.
Yeah. And I bet they're absolutely fucking furious that they have no leverage, right? Because the British government, they just decided. David Lammy went out and gave a speech over the weekend a couple days ago talking about how they did a review of whether British military assistance was being used in violation of international or domestic law. They just suspended about 30 arms export licenses to Israel on those grounds. So, like, shout out to David Lammy and the Labor Party for getting that done. But we should all know, though, this is an important but entirely symbolic step, because the British, the UK says its exports constitute only 0.02% of Israel's arms. The vast majority come from the US and Germany, about 70% come from the US. So if we took a courageous step like this, it would have an enormous impact.
And even
just
that,
enforcing current law.
Well, that's the thing. What Labor did was just within their framework. They said, we're going to do a review based on our own laws, you know? So if the US just took a starting point, and we've talked about this as a potential option for Kamala Harris to take, as just a starting point, if we just said, you know, we're actually, instead of doing these kind of like fake reviews and where we find the result we want, which is we're just going to keep giving Israel everything they want, we're just going to enforce the law and actually methodically investigate whether these weapons are going to potential human rights violations, that alone would be a tremendous piece of leverage. Just enforcing existing U.S. law. Bernie Sanders has a bill to suspend this $20 billion arms sale that they're trying to rush through. I mean, obviously that kind of thing should be on the table too. So there really are options here. This is what's so frustrating. I'm not suggesting that those options would magically fix everything, but not even trying to exert leverage is what I don't understand. Because the one thing, you know, why not at least, given how bad things are, try something different?
Yeah, and I have some friends who listen to the show and will text me and be like, you and Ben sound like some crazy lefty radicals on this issue. I'm like, no, listen to what people in Israel are saying. Yeah. Here's an example. We spoke to a man named Nadav Tamir about this weekend's protest. He's the executive director of J Street in Israel. J Street, by the way, was criticized for not being hard enough on Netanyahu, not calling for a ceasefire soon enough in this country. Here's a clip of what he said and saw on the streets.
For me personally, I had connections to two of the families. So it became very, you know, close at home. But I think the entire country got to know them. And it was so obvious that they could have been alive. And it was right after the, you know, there were leaks from the war cabinet where it was clear that the defense establishment think completely different than the prime minister. And the only reason that why the prime minister is not going for a deal is because of his political survival. I think the combination of all those things made it very unique. There was a lot of energy. And you saw many people that are not the usual suspects that I see every Saturday when I go to those demonstrations. And it was also a joint demonstration. It was not the usual split between the headquarters of the hostages and those who call for elections. They were all united. And it was the same message that Netanyahu is actually killing the hostages because he's avoiding a deal.
This is what Israelis are saying.
Yeah.
That Netanyahu is killing the hostages by not taking a deal.
Yeah. And these are largely motivated, again, just to show the complexity of this, this isn't even about, you know, the Palestinian circumstances in Gaza Strip. These are just Israelis who think the hostages should be out and Netanyahu is killing that. So it showcases the need from both a kind of policy perspective in terms of bringing leverage to bear, but also a discourse perspective of the need to just change how we're approaching this. And it's not some super left-wing thing to basically be like, why are we continuing to do something that's not working?
Yeah. And by the way, you mentioned how things are just getting worse every week. Last week, we talked about the polio outbreak that's happening in Gaza as we speak. There is a major vaccination effort happening to try to vaccinate children in the Gaza Strip to prevent this from spreading. We spoke with Louise Wateridge, a UN spokesperson in Gaza, about how that effort is going. Here's a clip.
You know, we're vaccinating for an extremely dangerous disease in the middle of a war zone. So while there is some respite in the sense that there are temporary humanitarian pauses while the vaccinations are you know, issued, the bombing continues after, the bombing continues in the night. And there's so many diseases spreading that we're trying to focus on polio, on this one disease, but on the backdrop that there's, you know, sewage running through the streets and people living on top of each other, hepatitis A spreading, So it's, you know, on the one hand, it's a relief that this campaign is going well, but as with many things in the Gaza Strip throughout this war, everything else remains to be such a huge challenge. It's just priorities. What do you need to do in a war zone? Is it a priority today to get children vaccinated, or is it a priority to get food? Is it a priority to get water? And then in 4 weeks, we have to do it all again. In 4 weeks, these children, 640,000 children, will need a second round of the polio vaccination drops. So it's going well, but we've still got a long way to go, and we have to take it every day as it comes.
It's worth noting that the IDF is helping facilitate this effort. I would imagine, Ben, in part because there are huge chunks, especially of the ultra-Orthodox population in Israel, that are unvaccinated. So polio will not stay in the Gaza Strip. It will come to Israel and it will affect huge parts of the population there if it spreads.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the only other thing I was going to say is you listen to that and you think about the people doing this work. I mean, the humanitarian workers that just keep going. And you know, you and I have heard the presentations by doctors and medical workers who've left Gaza. You know, the DNC had a panel with one. It's just extraordinary what these people are doing, you know. I mean, obviously they would usually say, I'm just doing my job, it's part of my identity, but shout out to the people going in there trying to vaccinate, kids.
Yeah, you're at risk of disease yourself, of
Yeah.
getting killed by Hamas, of getting killed by the IDF,
Yeah.
of getting just hurt or lost somewhere. I mean, it's unimaginable.
Yeah.
Final thing, I just want a point I want to make, Ben. I'm sure there are people listening who are thinking, okay, how can you guys talk like this about the Biden policy and then support Kamala Harris? Isn't what you're saying that they're just as bad as Trump? And I just want to say
No,
why I think that is
not saying
wrong.
that. Yeah.
Yeah. So
Not saying that.
Kamala Harris, first of all, has signaled that she disagrees with Biden on Gaza. We don't know how much. She doesn't have a lot of space. We'll find out, but it's up to us to push her, I think. However, Trump's team is 100% in support of Netanyahu and his right-wing government. And just an example to share with people. So Trump's former ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, has a new book out. In that book, he suggests that the United States should redirect $1 billion worth of aid that is supposed to go to the Palestinians, specifically to Palestinian security forces who are basically doing the IDF,
subcontractors for the occupation.
Doing the IDF's bidding to keep the West Bank secure, and put that money towards the annexation of the West Bank.
Yeah.
Miriam Adelson, the widow of the late right-wing billionaire Sheldon Adelson, has reportedly put like a wish list forward to Trump of things she wants for Israel policy. That includes annexation of the West Bank
for $100 million
and
in support for his campaign.
And I believe she spent something in the last time I checked, the number was like $55 million on the
Yeah.
super PAC.
Yeah.
So we don't know that Trump has accepted and agreed to that wish list, but I got to guess.
Well, the other thing, because there's been so much going on, you pointed to is the West Bank, right? And this is, I think, where the differences are most profound in the sense that the Israelis just launched this major military operation in the West Bank that, that kind of barely registered too. But it's of a piece of the fact that, the real end goal for Netanyahu is not Gaza. It's the annexation of the West Bank. You know, that's what the right-wing Israeli government is focused on. And Trump would just totally give a green light to that. Can you really see Trump going to the mat, over the West
No,
Bank?
God, no.
And so there's a real difference between existing U.S. policy and what Trump would do. And yeah, I think we have to take seriously, like, who's the president matters a lot in kind of the judgment calls you make. And Kamala Harris has been a part of this administration, has been a part of that Gaza policy, but I think clearly would approach the issue with a different perspective than Joe Biden, who was kind of very personally invested in this hug Bibi strategy. Like, he thought, he knew how to deal with Bibi, he knew how to deal with the Israelis. And so I think we do get something of an opportunity for not a totally fresh start, but at least a pivot with a Kamala Harris.
Yeah, agree with that. And with Trump, you get, I don't know,
Oh, you get,
Jared Kushner
yeah,
building condos
whatever the
in
right
Gaza
wing
or
wants
whatever.
in Israel, yeah.
Okay, enough of that.
Okay.
Before we go to break, two quick things, Ben. So nearly 57,000 of you, including your father, have signed up for Vote Save America's Organize or Else volunteer drive. Thank you again,
Yes,
Mr. Rhodes.
Jim
But
Rhodes.
we're not going to stop yapping about it until we hit our goal of 75,000 signups. The deadline is National Voter Registration Day on September 17th. The clock is ticking loud here, buddy. Go to votesaveamerica.com/2024. And right now, in less than 5 minutes, you will receive high impact volunteer actions you can take to help Democrats up and down the ticket. Even if you've never volunteered before, Vote Save America will make it easy and fun. So go to votesaveamerica.com/2024. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. And this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. Also, Ben, the first ever presidential debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris is set for Tuesday, September 10th. You
crazy,
excited?
Crazy. I mean,
you think it's going to happen?
Yeah, I'm a little nervous. But, you know,
a little nervous, I am too. I mean, the last one was catastrophic for one person.
I guess it's going to be better than that one.
Knock on wood, pal. We will find out, though, if it's good, it's bad. It could be a masterclass and Kamala just wiping the table with him. We'll see. If you're scared to watch alone, like Ben and I are, you can watch with us and the Friends of the Pod community to react, comment, meme it out in real time in our subscriber-only Discord chat. Subscribe now to join at crooked.com/friends.
Years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month, no commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
All right, this is going to be one of those bad news constantly episodes, though, Ben.
So interesting, though.
Interesting news. Stuff. Yeah. Our next story is out of Germany, where the ultra-right wing AfD party did extremely well in state parliamentary elections this past weekend. Ben's got his head in his hands. The AfD won the most votes in the state of Thuringia, where they got nearly one third of the vote. This is the first time a far-right party has won the most votes in a state election since the Nazi era. The AfD also did well in neighboring Saxony, where they got second place, losing to the conservative CDU party by a little bit more than a percentage point. So it was like 1.2%. A few pieces of context. So this is a regional election, not a countrywide election. So about 7% of the German population was eligible to vote. So it's not reflective of the entire country. Also, the other major political parties in Germany have so far ruled out forming a coalition with the AfD. So at the moment, it seems unlikely that they'll end up in a government, that there will be an AfD-led government in any of these states. But the AfD in Eastern Germany is especially extreme. They're like the far right of the far right. so much so that German intelligence has labeled them a threat to democracy itself. And the leader of the AfD party in Thuringia has been fined twice for using Nazi-era slogans. So these are like real deal fascists. According to various German political analysts, AfD candidates have successfully gained support by attacking immigration and German support for the war in Ukraine. And then, interestingly, there was a populist left-wing party called the BSW that took third in both elections, despite being, I think, formed less than a year ago. They have similar anti-immigrant views, similar anti-war views, but are just coming from essentially like a communist perspective. But they've also ruled out working with the AfD. So there's going to be another regional election in Eastern Germany in a few weeks in Brandenburg, which is currently controlled by the Social Democratic Party. So we'll see if like the people running the entire country, how they do against the AfD. So all of this is a prelude to a national election in about a year. So Ben, I think long story short, we probably don't have to explain to listeners why an ultra right-wing, some say neo-Nazi party in Germany coming to power would be bad. But the question is, what does Olaf Scholz, the current chancellor, do to stop them? Like his approval, I think, went from 73% in 2022 and is now down below 30%. So things are not good. He's in big trouble. He's leading this three-party coalition that is incredibly strained at the moment. And there is this constant debate about whether someone like Scholz should try to accommodate and co-opt parties like the AfD or fight them. Like, what's the best way to manage fascism?
I think we have a lot of takes on this podcast, Tommy, and I wouldn't expect anyone to agree with all those takes at all. But the one take I'm most confident of is that it's never a good thing when Nazis start winning elections in Germany.
I think that's right. We put that in a quote card.
Bad thing. Like, yeah. Let's just kind of put that in a box.
Bad and, news.
Like, agree to keep that Pandora's box closed. I mean, I think, look, part of what's alarming is that this is happening not just because of like something, you know, triggering it right now. There are like structural issues in German politics, you know, hostility to migration, kind of backlash to globalization like we've seen here, some identity issues, exacerbated by the cost of living, frustration with German support for Ukraine in the East, you know. And so these aren't issues that are going away. And that's what's kind of alarming is that the AfD is getting like steadily more traction. There's a lot of antibodies in German society to kind of reject this, and I'm confident that the majorities will band together and try to keep these people out of government, even when they won pluralities and not let them win a national election. But I think the problem is also that the AfD is kind of scrambling all of German politics, right? They're peeling off people from the right, you know, so the Christian Democrats, the center-right party, you know, they're kind of radicalizing some of those people and winning some of those votes. There's some people that are like in that weird space where they're like so far left that they're far right, mm-hmm. you know, so they're peeling off people from kind of the far left. And I think part of what's missing in terms of what can Olaf Scholz do or any German politician, there's a kind of admirable German political trait to not be particularly charismatic or populist because you're afraid of you know, right. like of being, you know, like Angela
back
Merkel.
Back to your original point.
Yeah, yeah. Obama used to say to Merkel, you need to speak up more, you know, you need to make kind of more values-based arguments for the Europe and all these things. And she'd say, like, Barack, you don't want a charismatic German chancellor, you know, which I thought was
Did
kind
she
of
know that was funny when she said
she
it?
Did. Okay. It was this kind of dry Angela Merkel yeah. joke that she used a couple of times. And both Merkel and Scholz, they all kind of reflect this kind of technocratic approach. I don't know. I think German politicians are going to have to find ways to start to be a little bit more populist, you know, for good, you know, in the sense that you don't want all the energy to be with people who just are like these lunatics on the far right. You don't want to just be perpetually defending an establishment that everybody's fed up with, you know. So there's room for some, you know, I like Olaf Scholz's politics, so you know, hopefully he could do it. But somebody's going to have to kind of connect a little bit more to the grievances people are feeling without succumbing to far-right solutions, right? Because otherwise you're kind of ceding all that terrain to these guys.
Yeah, I mean, we should note the other kind of big fight or experiment against the far right was in France,
yeah.
where President Macron called that snap election in July, where it seemed like after the first round, the far right parties were going to romp and just, you know, maybe win an outright majority. And then in the second round, they did significantly worse. It was in absolute terms, it was very bad for Macron and his party, but it did seem to like blunt their momentum. However, they still haven't formed a government. They don't have a prime minister. They're like, it was seen as this impressive jujitsu move to deal with Marine Le Pen. But now Macron refuses to name a candidate from the far left coalition because he hates them too. So it's led to this political impasse. And so I think you're seeing a similar dynamic in Germany The AfD won an outright, not a majority, but they won the most votes in one of these provinces, but no one is going to form a coalition with them. So they'll still be out of government. So they'll still get to play this grievance card and act like, you know, the will of the people is not being heard because this neo-Nazi party is not in government and they have no responsibility for anything still.
So
it's just a question of how you defeat these people politically if they never assume responsibility for anything and get electoral consequences for failing to manage it.
Yeah. And look, I can't get too into the weeds of the intricacies of French political personalities for that role. But I mean, I think ultimately Macron needs to sign off on someone to his left being prime minister. Like, that's how they won the election, you know. But in part because, again, like, it's not good. By the way, it wasn't good when Kamala Harris is doing better here, and not to wade too much into American political analysis, by literally running as a bit of a change candidate, even though she's vice president. Joe Biden was in the same trap that Macron and Schultz have been in, which is he's just defending a status quo. It's like, you know, defending the neoliberal order, you know, like right, that's what people are pissed about. And so all these politicians have to find ways to open up a vein of not just defending the institutions, but also reforming them, you know. And for Macron, that's got to be indicating that he gets that he didn't win a mandate in that election. And insofar as the far right was defeated, the left helped him do that. So yeah, there may be certain people he doesn't want to see as prime minister, but he's got to ideologically compromise here.
Yeah, Macron's like, but how about those Olympics?
Yeah.
Pretty good, huh?
Yeah.
See, the
whoever was in charge of the Olympics maybe should be prime minister, because that was pretty fucking great Olympics.
Yeah, it was great. Although I heard a story today where I guess the mayor of Paris wants to keep the Olympic rings on the Eiffel Tower in perpetuity.
I'm not sure.
That's like having like your high school football trophies on the shelf. It's time to move on. Okay, next story, Ben. So we got this late-breaking story out of New York today where apparently a former aide to current New York Governor Kathy Hochul and this woman worked for the former governor, Andrew Cuomo, was arrested and charged with acting as a foreign agent for the Chinese government, also charged with money laundering and conspiracy to commit bank fraud. So this woman's name is Linda Sun. She's a 40-year-old. She worked her way up the ladder in state government to become deputy chief of staff to Hochul. And then she left that job and I think was working in the New York Labor Department. Her husband was also charged. He's a businessman. Linda Sun allegedly worked to block meetings between Taiwanese officials and New York state leaders. She worked to remove references to Taiwan or the Uyghurs in various state communications, and then did some other favors for, you know, sort of the Chinese government. In return, the Chinese government funneled money into her husband's businesses in China, and then she and her husband, Linda Sun and her husband, used that money to buy a bunch of multi-million dollar houses and a 2024 Ferrari.
Yes.
I don't know how you can be like a state government worker and get away with having a Ferrari.
You forgot the chef's kiss, which is that they delivered Peking duck dinners prepared by the consulate chef to her parents.
Yeah, so like the head of the Chinese consulate.
Succulent duck.
Who prepared Peking ducks and deliver it to her parents.
Yeah, yeah.
So none of this was very subtle.
I have a lot of thoughts on this. I mean, first of all, it's amazing to me that the Chinese were paying, like these people had millions of dollars. And yeah, when you go into the details, she's blocking a few meetings with the Taiwanese. She was getting some like fake proclamations or something that they give to visiting delegations with like the seal of New York on it. I mean, she wasn't delivering the nuclear codes. And so on the one end, that makes you think like, what are the Chinese paying for? And how did this person, like you said, think they could get away with having all these, they had like a $2 million place in Hawaii or something.
Yeah.
Did they think no one would notice? But the alarming thing is you do keep hearing more and more, and we saw the scandal in the UK where there are, you know, severe security compromises from Chinese intelligence. We've heard the same thing in Canada. If they're spending this much money on like a relatively obscure, albeit senior state official, it does kind of make you wonder like how far the tentacles are running of their intelligence operations.
This was my exact reaction. I was like, on the one hand, this is kind of a shocking example of the Chinese government penetrating like a New York state government office at the highest level.
Just how much they care that they're paying attention to like state government.
Yeah, like deputy chief of staff, the New York governor, like that's a big deal. That's someone with a lot of power. Yeah. On the other hand, one of the things that Linda Sun allegedly did for them was the intersection sent in a request for a Lunar New Year video. And Linda's son worked to make sure it didn't mention the Uyghurs.
Yeah.
You couldn't just edit that out.
It just shows how like this kind of thin-skinned approach is so like they're in state governments, they're probably in local governments. I mean, the thing you also worry about, the intelligence penetration that might exist if they have this kind of far-reaching effort. But you also hope that there's not some backlash against Asian Americans in political life suddenly being suspected. You know, like there's got to be a way to approach this that is you know, more deliberate than that, too.
Yeah. Also worth reading, the Washington Post did this deep dive into pro-Chinese Communist Party demonstrators that were sent into the streets of San Francisco, apparently directed by the Chinese consulate in L.A., around the APEC summit, whenever that was, 2 years ago, last year. Yeah. So they were like, so Xi Jinping was in San Francisco for this summit. They knew they were going to be anti-CCP protesters. So they sent basically a bunch of thugs to the area to beat the shit out of them. And there's videos of it.
Yeah, Erdogan did the same thing. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beat the crap out of our people. And Trump was like, cool.
Yeah. I mean, there's a level of aggression in this kind of thuggery and kind of, meticulous attention to detail, right? Like, yeah, the Lunar New Year statement. Who gives a shit, you know?
Yeah, it's a desire to censor everything all times.
It shows how their mindset of total control at home like kind of spills over into how they look at the world, you know,
well said.
The CCP.
Speaking of total control, if you are a Twitter addict like Ben and I are, you should not go to Brazil because as of Saturday, the service is no longer available there. Here's why. Back in April, I think we talked about this at the time, Ben, a judge named Alexandre de Moraes, forgive me, Portuguese speakers, if I'm getting that wrong, Moraes, I think is how you say it, demanded that Twitter shut down dozens of accounts in Brazil for spreading disinformation and pushing narratives to overturn the 2022 election. That was the election where Lula da Silva defeated Jair Bolsonaro, who then encouraged his followers to storm the Capitol. Sounds familiar. Musk refused the request to shut down these accounts, and then he ordered Twitter's offices in Brazil closed so that none of his staff could be arrested for refusing to comply with this judicial order. So Judge Moraes ordered Twitter to name a legal representative in Brazil. Twitter refused, and that led to the suspension on Saturday. So the way this works is it's pretty comprehensive. So Brazilian internet service providers were told to block access to Twitter. The court told Apple and Google to remove Twitter from the App Store in Brazil. I should be calling it X, but I think X is such a lame name that I just can't say it. So I'm going to say Twitter. And then if you try to access Twitter with a VPN, you can be fined nearly $9,000. So it's like pretty comprehensive and intense. According to the BBC, Brazil even froze the bank accounts of another Elon Musk company, Starlink, the satellite company in Brazil, to try to, you know, get more leverage. So again, this is a big deal in Brazil. The Associated Press said 40 million Brazilians use Twitter at least once a month, about a fifth of the country. Previously, there's a long history of Brazil being pretty hard ass against social media companies. They suspended WhatsApp service in Brazil a couple times in 2015 and 2016 after the company refused to comply with law enforcement requests for user data. This same judge got into a huge fight with Telegram. We talked about them last week. Actually, we'll have a quick update on that.
Pavel Bure.
Pavel Durov, the CEO who was arrested in France. And I think charged with some pretty intense charges about the failure to deal with child sexual material being spread on the platform. So that story is not going anywhere. Elon tweeted that he's going to have Starlink provide free internet service to Brazilians until all of this is sorted out. So anyway, everyone's got too much power here.
Yeah.
I don't know, Ben. I'm still like torn. Look, my American First Amendment, you know, kind of spirit comes out here when I hear about an unelected judge deciding that you can block an entire social media service in a country. It does feel a little authoritarian. On the other hand,
so does Elon.
Yeah. So I don't know. How are you feeling about this?
I mean, it does feel like the response from Elon Musk, right, of basically telling these people to completely fuck off is, you know,
quite literally sometimes.
Yeah. It's not a constructive response. You know, so this is one where his kind of pugilist, you know, blundering American CEO kind of ethos, kind of escalates the issue. I think my main takeaway is, first of all, even if you do ban X there, you know, I think history shows and kind of people migrate to other platforms, right? So you're not going to end disinformation with an action like this. But it does start to show, I think that the other bigger point is that I think we may be entering a period where there is a normalization of much more aggressive government action against social media platforms. We've already seen the US pass a law banning TikTok. We'll see if that goes into force. We've seen the French kind of making this pretty aggressive move against Telegram. We see Brazil banning X. I kind of feel like we're heading into a chapter in this experimentation of social media breaking our brains and political cultures, where you're going to see kind of these ad hoc, you know, what you'd like to see is governments getting together and being like, how do we regulate this? How do we kind of slow the poison of algorithms that, you know, turbocharge anger and fear and stuff? In the place of that, I think what we're going to get are these like pretty, you know, knee-jerk movements to ban this platform or that platform in this country or that country. And it'll be interesting to see how that kind of shakes out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Elon's also in fights with regulators in the UK, with the European Union. I mean, it's weird. You read these stories and he's often described as a free speech absolutist. And then a couple months later, he winds up at a meeting with Xi Jinping in China to try to hawk more Teslas. So I don't know.
No,
not sure I totally buy
that. There may be some, the Venn diagram, as Kamala Harris would say, may have an overlapping circle of his self-interest and his ad hoc commitment to free speech.
Yeah, I think that's right. Speaking of reform, so Mexico's outgoing president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, as he's known, has a month left in office. And so naturally, he's trying to jam through a major overhaul of the judicial system through Mexico's Congress, where his party has a supermajority in the lower house and is just one seat shy of that in the Senate. So AMLO wants a number of constitutional reforms, including the direct election of more than 7,000 judges in Mexico and a reduction of the number of Supreme Court justices and their term lengths. AMLO claims that this is a way to root out corruption, but judges and judicial employees and human rights activists in the country's opposition all see it as a threat to having an independent judiciary. There have been some big demonstrations both for and against this move by AMLO, including strike by judicial workers. Anti-reform protesters actually forced the legislators to move the debate to a sports arena because they formed a human chain around the lower house building. That's an impressive protest. Mm-hmm. We caught up with our buddy Dan Restrepo, the founding partner of Dinamica Americas, who spoke about the complicated nature of popular debate around these reforms, given the popularity of AMLO and his lefty authoritarianism. Here's a clip from that conversation.
You have to admit, and the reason he's able to do this is López Obrador's political movement is very popular. He, over the course of the last 6 years, has delivered for the Mexican population. They just delivered electorally for his successor, Claudia Sheinbaum, who will take office on October 1st. Where she won the most votes any freely elected president has won in the history of Mexico. So at some level, there's a lot of popular support for this, but there's also a significant concern in the population and outside the country, and quite frankly, in the folks who are going to have to interact with the judiciary are raising concerns about what does it mean to have a directly elected judicial entity, particularly at a time when López Obrador is trying to undermine the ability of the electoral authority to carry out elections.
So Dan mentioned to us also in that conversation that there's only a few places in the world with directly elected judges, some parts of the U.S. At the state level, and then in Bolivia, where they recently put in place direct elections, and I think now a lot of people regret it. There's a lot of politicization of judges that's leading to problems. A number of members of Congress have been critical of this plan by AMLO. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Ken Salazar, said that he believes, quote, a popular direct election of judges is a major risk to the functioning of Mexico's democracy. That resulted in AMLO halting diplomatic relations with the U.S. embassy. So, Ben, Mexico just elected a new president, Claudia Sheinbaum, as Dan mentioned. She is a protege of AMLO. The question I think a lot of political observers have had is they don't know a lot about what she really thinks. Is she going to have autonomy and really be in charge, or is AMLO going to continue to try to pull the strings from offstage? I wonder if you think this kind of 11th hour power grab suggests that that will be the case, or is this him trying to get done all the things he wants to get done before he's gone?
I mean, it certainly feels like a guy who's like, okay, here's a pretty contentious reform that's on my list, and I'd rather, you know, I'm wildly popular, I'm on the way out, I'm going to try to ram this thing through on the way out the door so she doesn't have to, you know, kind of makes it, takes one thing off her plate, you know, in terms of the agenda that he wants to implement. Yeah, I do think it's problematic as much as it sounds good, right? Elect judges, you know, we've seen in Israel, we've seen in this country, in the United States, when you kind of start messing with the character of the judiciary, it's very destabilizing. And yeah, like he's, you know, he's got broad popular support, but, you know, when it's the judiciary, you're talking about institutions that are going to shape people's lives 10 years from now, 20 years from now. It's not just like win an election, do certain policies. That said, I think to Dan's point, there's this kind of dismissive attitude sometimes towards AMLO that kind of disregards the fact that he's really popular, you know, and the, and that, you know, the institutions that a lot of the, you know, institutionalists are defending have been widely perceived as corrupt for a very long time in Mexico. So, you know, you'd like to see a meeting in the middle, right, between AMLO, you know, not pushing reforms so fast that they're kind of breaking apart these institutions and losing the confidence of, you know, an important minority of the population there. But you'd also like to see people meet AMLO in the middle and Sheinbaum, Elton wins her. And she offers that opportunity. She might be like a somewhat less, from everything we've seen about her, she's unlikely to have like, you know, 3-hour daily talk shows where she excoriates her enemies. Right. You know, she's a little more technocratic. So that might be an opportunity to kind of find some new, you know, center in Mexican politics.
I always forget that Ken Salazar is our U.S. ambassador down there. He's a former U.S. senator.
Yeah.
By all accounts, like a very good guy. But he seems to be like the only official in the government that regularly does battle with AMLO.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the U.S., the White House doesn't seem to want to pick a fight. They just want help on immigration
fentanyl. Yeah.
But then Ken Salazar just gets bludgeoned.
He's getting PNG'd left and right. I mean, what I was thinking when I saw this, Tommy, is that, like, how awkward for Joe Biden, because they've actually managed to really arrest flows across the border. Kamala Harris's electoral fortunes are obviously tied in part to kind of how chaotic the border looks. And so AMLO has this massive leverage, and Sheinbaum will after, you know, because like if they stop playing ball with us on migration, it causes huge political problems in the U.S. And so it does kind of limit, you know, your willingness to take on these things.
Yeah, so you're just an ambassador, like kind of trying to do the right thing, but I wonder if he feels hung out to dry. I mean, I don't know. I'm guessing. I'm wondering aloud.
Someone's got to speak for Ken Salazar, man.
That's what I'm talking about, man. We'll find out. Maybe he'll write into the show. Couple more things, Ben. So we had some really bad news earlier this morning before we started recording. We have had on this show a couple times a Ugandan opposition leader named Bobi Wine. Bobi Wine was an incredibly popular singer who decided to run for office against Uganda's corrupt, autocratic, authoritarian leader, Yoweri Museveni. In response, Bobby and a lot of his supporters faced brutal repression, physical violence. They had votes stolen from them. So as bad as it gets. And earlier today, we saw that Bobby was shot and wounded in a confrontation with police. It's not exactly clear what happened yet. This is, you know, late breaking. I was talking to a friend in Africa who said he wasn't sure whether Bobby was hit with a bullet or maybe he had been shot with something like a tear gas canister. Either way, it can, like, can cause real damage. But the fear is in Uganda that this is just the latest example of Museveni's people pushing the envelope to see how much violence they can inflict on their political opponents and get away with it. So hopefully the U.S. government will say something, and it's not just like we are monitoring reports and concerned, you know, it's something a little tougher than that. But I mean, this is a very big deal.
Yeah, I mean, Bobby and his wife, Barbie, actually, you know, were in the studio, and I make that point because he could easily have left, right? I mean, he's kind of got a global reputation. He was the subject of a, you know, Oscar-nominated documentary film. You know, he could have taken his activism someplace else. And he's one of these people that chose to go back to Uganda knowing he'd be in danger. You know, and there's some pretty inspiring pictures of him leading marches, tens of thousands of people, you know, upon his return. So the first point is it just speaks to his courage and just being there and keeping up this fight in the face of like immense risk. If, you know, we'll see what happened if he was just shot. I mean, that's a very ominous, you know, warning sign. Maybe that was the intent. We don't know yet. And yeah, to your point, the U.S. does provide a lot of assistance to Uganda. I mean, this needs to be more than just a kind of, as you said, perfunctory statement of concern and monitoring. That, you know, they're like, as we talked about Israel, like, you know, if you don't have consequences, you know, you shouldn't expect a different result. So
Yeah, and I was just looking at Bobby's Twitter feed. I mean, they have a video up where they said you can clearly hear someone yelling, shoot him, these security forces, right before Bobby was shot in the leg. So, I mean, if that's the case, you have to imagine the administration should be reviewing this, whatever this security force, and whether they're receiving any direct U.S. assistance, because this is a pretty clear human rights violation that cannot happen. Absolutely. So one we'll keep monitoring. Also, Ben, I mean, you know, we talked about this in depth a couple weeks ago, but the situation for women in Afghanistan is just unbearable. There are new so-called vice and virtue laws published by the Taliban that state that, quote, whenever an adult woman leaves her home out of necessity, she is obliged to conceal her voice, face, and body. So that means women can never show their face, they can't speak, they can't read or sing in public. This is obviously an attempt to stamp out women from public life entirely, not let them exist. But one incredible thing that's happening is that women are doing what they can to be defiant. There's clips going up on social media of Afghan women singing publicly. Here's a clip. زدی تا امر ثانی مهر خاموشی دهانم را محیا می کنی تا امر ثانی آب و نانم را مرا با جرم زن بودن اسیر خانه ام کردی. It reminds me of the protest movement in Iran when, you know, just sort of basic acts like walking around with your hair uncovered or singing publicly or releasing a song were viewed as acts of defiance. A couple weeks ago, I referenced this a minute ago, you spoke with Sahar Halamzai from the Malala Fund, who made a point of noting that their fight for women's rights is most forcefully coming from women in Afghanistan themselves who are risking their lives to do so. These laws, though, they're not just targeting women. Taxi drivers are forbidden from giving rides to women without a male escort. Women are not supposed to befriend other women. So it's clearly a process that is an effort to essentially criminalize being a woman in society that is not just trapped in your home from the Taliban.
Yeah, and to the point about Sahar, when she was on, she talked about, you know, this is gender apartheid. And a reason I think that's a useful paradigm is it kind of globalizes the issue, right, in the sense that I would hope a Kamala Harris administration, you get a sense that because the Afghan withdrawal didn't go particularly, you know, well, obviously, the Biden team kind of low profiles the issue of Afghanistan a bit.
Yeah.
I think Kamala could come in and make a kind of a renewed push on the issue of women in Afghanistan, you know, off of these laws, among other things, but also kind of globalize it to this, you know, she can be a spokesperson, as she has been in this country, on gender equality for, you know, gender abuse, gender apartheid, you know, around the world. And Afghanistan and Iran are probably the two most prominent places for it. The other thing that stands out to me, Tommy, on, you know, what was a pretty bleak day, but in each of these stories, like there really are these kind of heroic people, like the Afghan women, you know, risking everything to be heard and to kind of assert their humanity, all the way back to the hostage families in Israel pushing for a ceasefire, to the medical workers in Gaza, to, you know, Palestinians, to, you know, Tom talks about, you know, people in Sudan, what they, you know, there are good guys out there, you know, Bobby Wine, you know, and many of whom are risking a lot, you know, and you just feel like we're in this period where, you know, the stakes are big because everybody knows that there's a lot on the line everywhere, you know.
Yeah, and you know, sort of back to the conversation we had about Gaza, where the political discourse in the U.S. is just the dumbest version of what we should be talking about. I mean, there's been a controversy over the last few days and weeks about the Trump administration or the Trump campaign trying to highlight the 3-year anniversary of the withdrawal from Afghanistan by having Trump go to Arlington National Cemetery with a bunch of his goons on his campaign team to film essentially an attack ad or campaign video or TikTok, which is against the rules at Arlington. You're not, like, Section 60 is this like hallowed part of Arlington. It's where the post 9/11, it's where people killed in post 9/11 wars are buried. And you are not supposed to film things there. It doesn't matter if you have permission from a family. It's just a place that's treated as hallowed ground. And Trump went there with a bunch of videographers and apparently got into a scuffle with someone who works at Arlington, and they posted all these videos of him there anyway, including a photo of Trump. Like, giving a thumbs up.
Yeah, yeah.
At the graveside.
Yeah, like he was meeting the head of some like local Rotary Club in the Oval Office. You know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. He's with some of the families, a family of someone who was killed at the Abbey Gate attack during the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and so clearly those family members wanted Trump there. They appreciated whatever he's saying about, you know, their son or daughter. And so I respect that. But again, you're not supposed to create like political videos at Arlington, period. And yet, I don't know. It's like you would think this would be a campaign ending thing to do something this hackish, but Trump is just able to get away with it. And his campaign acts with such impunity when they're called out on this stuff.
Yeah, there's the obvious point of just, you know, if I told you, you know, 10, 15 years ago that there'd be a guy who got caught, you know, trying to campaign in Section 60 of Arlington National Cemetery, and his campaign got in a fist fight with like the, you know, staffer from Arlington National Cemetery and then attacked his mental health and their statements. I mean, it just shows this guy is completely, you know, missing in any gene that should put him anywhere close to the presidency. But the other point is the one you make, which is part of what Trump does is he kind of reflects back the stupidity of how issues are covered in the United States, because essentially he has no policy difference on Afghanistan. He negotiated the withdrawal that led to the kind of chaotic end of things. It's not like he would have had some different, you know, formula for protecting troops at the Abbey Gate. He just knows that that was a bad political week for Joe Biden and that the right wing has probably spent, you know, millions of hours attacking Joe Biden for the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. And so he's not even like speaking to people's brains. He's just kind of speaking to a media narrative. You know, like if I go out and talk about, you know, the withdrawal of Afghanistan, you know, that's like in the funhouse mirror of American politics. Like that's, and by the way, he desperately still wants to be running against Joe Biden.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I don't think anybody thinks like Kamala Harris was responsible for the withdrawal. So it's just, it's pointless. As well as being offensive for him to be doing this.
Yeah, he tries to film a campaign ad at Arlington. His staff gets into a physical altercation with someone who works there who wants them just to obey the rules. Then Trump tweets out or truths out, quote, "It was a made-up story by Comrade Kamala and her misinformation squad." That nonsense somehow leads these articles.
Yeah, it's
about what happens.
So fucking dumb.
What are we doing here?
What are we doing?
To your point, like by all accounts, everything I've read, It's very clear that Joe Biden was the one who wanted to end the war in Afghanistan for what I think are good and honorable reasons.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean the rollout and their withdrawal went perfectly. But the idea that like they can make this, lay this at Harris's feet, I think is nuts.
It just shows you that they are living inside their own media ecosystem.
That's right.
I mean, because I just don't think this is even like, let's say they pulled off their campaign stop at Arlington. I don't think this is some giant winning issue where people are going to go into the voting booths thinking about the Abbey Gate, right? But because they live inside of the cartoon version of this they've created, they think it gets a lot more traction than it actually does.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Finally, Ben, last issue before we get to your interview. We have all heard people criticize so-called hashtag activism on the show. But I saw a tweet today that I think took it to a whole new level. It was from a guy named Mark Dubowitz.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad we're talking about this.
He is the head of an organization called the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. This is the tweet. Quote, "Please send me your actionable ideas on how to topple the regime in Iran. This is a major priority for me and at FDD. I promise that as many of the good ones as possible will be put into action," end quote. So, admittedly, Ben, I've never toppled a regime from my home.
Not on Twitter. Yeah.
But presumably it involves killing a lot of people, no?
I mean, the thing, okay, like this guy Dubowitz is like was like the worst version of a hackish Iran deal opponent, but also just, you know.
Should we set the table on FDD?
Yeah, let's
give us your description of FDD.
So FDD is called the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and it's mainly been the hub for a certain kind of DC punditry slash activism that does the bidding of the Gulf states, some of whom fund the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, irony not intended, and the Israeli government. Similarly, not exactly the most small D democratic crowd in the world. And they've kind of just driven like the most hardline anti-Iran agenda possible, like sanction after sanction. And again, another theme of this day's show, Tommy, which I regret to some extent, is media criticism. Because I'm not, you know, I'm not one of these people that thinks that somehow magically, like the mainstream liberal media, quote unquote, can, you know, erase Trump from our politics by having sterner headlines. But the thing about Dubovitz is he's credibly quoted in like almost every article that you could ever read about Iran as like an analyst. And look, that's literally like, you know, he's always, this guy is an advocate, an activist for regime change, you know, like he's sitting there like just outing himself saying like, I'm just sitting here. All I do all day is think about how to like overthrow this government. That's not some dispassionate, you know, analyst of nuclear and sanctions related issues, right? That's a guy with like a lot of skin in the fucking game. And he's, you know, foreign funded in some cases.
Yeah, the FDD gets money from the biggest bold name Republican donors. Sheldon Adelson, Paul Singer, the Home Depot founder, Bernie Marcus.
Home Depot guy's really nuts. Yeah,
he's really out there. Yeah. I think he gave $10 million.
Someone, don't tell Tim Walz.
So these are like people that hate Obama, people that want to topple Iran, and people that have the kind of like right-wing policy, most right-wing policy vision for Israel.
And love Bibi and MBS.
Love Bibi, love MBS. And they create this organization that's just like pure AstroTurf that holds these, you know, meetings or whatever. But it gets quoted in the New York Times all the time.
All the time.
It's like, just like an Iran analyst.
It's
I'm with you.
And why would anybody know that? You know, anybody reading would be like, oh, this person's sitting in a think tank and they're like, you know, but like they never identify like, you know, what the agenda is.
Yeah. I find a lot of media criticism on social media like very tiresome and just like wasted energy. Like if you're yelling about a New York Times headline all the time, or like, why hasn't the Ed Board called on Trump to resign every single day? Like, what are we doing here? But there are ways that the media gets manipulated. And part of it is organizations like this creating events and materials and op-eds and putting out people to shape the narrative.
It's an information
campaign.
Yeah. It's an information campaign. And so it should be presented as such.
Anyway, so you have any good ideas for how to topple the regime?
The thing that is actually helping prop up the regime is the perpetuation of all these like FDD type organizations, right? Because it gives the regime the enemy they need.
So
maybe we could take down the regime if we just got rid of all this AstroTurf.
Okay.
And the focus was actually on the nature of the Iranian government to its own people instead of like, you know, fighting back against the Mark Dubovitzes of the world.
Well, there you go, Mark. Free idea for you. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And we come back, you are going to hear Ben's interview with Tom Perriello about the situation in Sudan. So stick around for that.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month, no commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, so we've talked several times about the awful civil war in Sudan here on the podcast. Since the violence broke out between two warring factions in April of 2023, more than 8 million people have been displaced. Many tens of thousands have been killed. And according to the UN, the world's largest hunger crisis has unfolded. Today, we're really pleased to be joined by the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan, Tom Perriello, who's working hard to try to address this multifaceted catastrophe. Tom, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for covering this, Ben.
So just to begin with, you recently wrapped up a round of U.S.-mediated talks in Geneva. I know you were focused on trying to open up some additional routes for humanitarian aid. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in Geneva and what's coming out of that?
Yeah, I mean, we have a crisis that's just hard to wrap your head around when you're talking about, you know, 20 million people who've had to flee their homes and are facing acute hunger. You have a million facing starvation. I was on a call Sunday with some of the regional Sudanese coordinators of these local food kitchens. And in the process of the 90-minute call, three of the volunteers were killed in shellings just during that period. It's a matter of just horrendous life and death and terror every day, particularly for women who are facing both starvation and rape as a weapon of war. And this is 16th, 17th month of the conflict. We had a difficult time getting talks started because one of the sides, the army, did not want to attend. And frankly, one of our co-hosts didn't seem to want to host. And so President Biden and Secretary Blinken gave us the green light to try something a bit creative. And we ended up with what was a combination of in-person proximity and hybrid or virtual talks. So we basically had a group in Switzerland that included some of the best humanitarian aid and ceasefire experts in the world, some key countries from the region, the UN, the African Union, and we would get together in the morning and hear, okay, where are the roads getting stuck? Where are we not getting food through? Okay, to break through that, what do we need? We need this from the RSF. We need this from the army. We need this from the Chadian government. And then we would go out and basically work phones and work with the two warring sides, but also the neighboring countries and try to get things done. And we got two routes open. We've had over 7 million pounds delivered. We're stopped by rains the last 2 days. We're getting a third route open, and that's, you know, trying to get close to all 20 million people having food access that didn't, you know, at the beginning of last month.
So this is such a multifaceted problem. And as you mentioned, you've got the Sudanese armed forces fighting against the RSF, this kind of warlord-led militia group. Then you've got the neighboring states who are dealing with both incoming flows of people, but also their potential platforms to get aid in. Then you have all these external countries that are providing support to one side or the other. Before we get into a couple of the specifics of that, in your job, who are you engaging? You know, because you're trying to improve the humanitarian situation. Ultimately, you'd like, I'm sure, to pursue a political settlement. But with all of those actors, just in your role as envoy, like, who do you find yourself interacting with?
So we try to make sure I'm talking to about 1,000 Sudanese per week through virtual communication. There's still telecom to much of the country, as well as refugee population that's spread around places I go a lot, Addis, Cairo, Kampala, Entebbe, Nairobi. And so you have the Sudanese population that's very spread, in addition to significant diaspora communities here in the U.S. and Europe. Then in terms of the key regional actors, it's, again, a lot. All the neighboring countries are affected, whether by accepting refugees, in many cases overlapping ethnic communities. That's, you know, Chad and Egypt and South Sudan. I've been to South Sudan, but engaged there, Eritrea, Ethiopia, et cetera. In fact, my nieces have been memorizing all the countries that border Sudan. But then there are key players in the region, which is really in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates axis, that's very central. the African Union has been playing a key role in the political dialogue, as well as supporting the talks that we were on. So it's really a lot in the region. And then back here, it's an issue that still has strong bipartisan support on the Hill. Both Republicans and Democrats on the House and the Senate have long had a deep engagement with the Sudanese people. So it's getting back, meeting with the White House, meeting with the Hill folks. I'm up to New York tomorrow. So basically a lot of time on airplane tarmacs.
And when it comes just to the aid piece of it, before we get into the politics, is the impediment that these groups are using, you know, literal starvation as a weapon of war, so therefore the two warring sides are actually just denying entry to assistance? Or how much of it is a logistical challenge of just getting food to people who are in such need? What is the biggest problem set to just feeding people who are on the brink of famine here?
Yeah. So it's a man-made famine, and the answer of what got us to the famine conditions is different than what's keeping us in the famine conditions. So what got us there was primarily the rapid support forces burning all the harvests, burning through the warehouses of food, stealing the warehouses, robbing the convoys, making it a very difficult area in which for humanitarian aid to deliver. Then once the RSF had taken a surprisingly large amount of territory, the army basically, as a form of weak muscle flexing, said, well, we're going to do this note verbal. We're basically going to say nothing can come across the Adre border into some of the most famine-stricken areas, even though they have no actual de facto control over that border. They're hundreds of miles from it. So, and they said, you know, they were concerned about weapons coming across, which would be a legitimate concern, except for the fact that their note verbal doesn't stop a single bad actor from coming across the border. The only thing it stops is UN trucks. And unfortunately, it's like kryptonite for UN trucks. It's a 1,300 kilometer border. I used to sneak across it a bunch when I was doing documentation of Darfur abuses many years ago. It's a very porous border. And so this was clearly a decision by the SAF and the government to say, we want to starve these people that are in RSF territory in order to, you know, fill in the blank, to create that weakness, that pressure, to sort of suggest some sense of sovereignty over the country. And the only people who paid the price for it were the most weak and vulnerable. So for the last 5 or 6 months, really, that has been just a paralysis to the UN system because of the way that it tends to operate in countries. So that was a big part of the negotiations in Geneva, was getting this showdown first with President Burhan's permission to cross, and then the rear guard action from the Islamists and hardliners in his own government. And so if there was any question that they were actively trying to starve people, it was clear when they tried to undermine the president's decision to open this western border that was the intent. So it's just been that. Now you have the rainy season. And so there are days where trucks can't cross through because of the rains. That was one of the reasons we wanted this breakthrough before the rainy season. So there are natural limitations that will last several more weeks, but it's been almost entirely man-made in terms of the crisis itself and the famine.
And when you look at the politics, there's not a lot of good guys in this picture at all. But, you know, the RSF in particular, you know, has been engaged in, you know, reported atrocities and, as you mentioned, kind of contributed to this kind of man-made hunger crisis. The UAE is coming in for kind of particular focus as a supporter in terms of potential arms and resources to the RSF. And there's been a lot of calls to try to utilize some greater leverage on the UAE or try to at least cut off that role that they're playing. How do you approach that? Is there a way to leverage external parties that are contributing and arming the factions fighting in Sudan as a pathway to a political solution?
Well, I sure didn't have Macklemore as hero for Sudan on my bingo card, We'll come back to that. He canceled a concert recently in Abu Dhabi and standing in solidarity with Sudanese people. We have seen, unfortunately, a number of external countries playing a very negative role in fueling this conflict, whether that's UAE, Iran, Russia, and others. And we see, unfortunately, more of those actors coming in at this point. As you mentioned, the Rapid Support Forces really has its roots in the Janjaweed militias that were infamous in the 03, 04, 05 period in conducting the genocide against the various African tribes of Western Darfur, the Fur, the Mosalit, the Zagawa. And it's both true that this is they are the inheritors of that, but they're also more than that. They became a multi-billion dollar gold corporate enterprise and an active mercenary group to other actors. So they came into this war much more funded and battle hardened, I think, than the army had realized, which is part of why you've seen several rounds of military victories by this militia group against the established army. But it's all power. It's just about power. The people rose up in 2019, this incredibly inspiring revolution to throw off decades of the Bashir regime and all of that repression, to have their democratic future. World was inspired, and there was a temporary, power sharing with the military, and the military, for all of its complaining about the RSF, it was the military that brought the RSF to sort of legal status, and it was the military that joined forces with them for a coup, essentially, against the civilian transition, and then they couldn't agree on the power between the two of them. There's an ethnic overlay of them being two separate Arab ethnic groups. The one that runs the military traditionally looks down on the other and doesn't let them in the country club. And then both of them have traditionally been very repressive of the African tribes around the peripheries. So there are all these different elements of the war that you can come in on it. But at its essence, it's a question of whether which of these groups wants to have total power over the country, and the clearness that the people don't want that. They want a democratic and inclusive future. And they're looking for the U.S. to be an ally on that. And President Biden has stepped up and tried to do what we can.
So and just in terms of, reaching some, political solution, no matter how distant that may appear on the horizon, is that, a kind of power sharing negotiation among these, warring factions, the Sudanese Armed Forces and the RSF? Is it some kind of external framework that is like imposed on Sudan? What do you see as the most likely pathway, even if it may still be a long shot, towards a political resolution?
In some ways, the nice thing here is that the simplest solution is also the right solution, which is to just restore the civilian transition. People want a unity civilian government. There's almost total consensus on that among the Sudanese people, north, south, east, and west. They want that to be essentially a caretaker government until elections. That is really the only way through the standoff militarily right now as well. I think that the challenge is that people, oppressive groups, don't tend to give up power voluntarily. And so there's this question of what gets back to that, particularly since the established military has gotten pretty crushed militarily into a smaller number of states. Nobody wants to see the RSF win and take political power. Now they're claiming that they will hand power over to a civilian unity government the second they win. But outside of the last seat of Gladiator, you don't see that happen very often. So I think we're not going to bank on that solution. But I think the people do want that path to power. They want to see these guys step down. They do want to see a unified professional military over time. But unfortunately, right now, we see more fracturing in ways that are continuing to increase suffering at a just unspeakable level.
And one other thing I wanted to cover with you, Tom, is, this is such an important issue from a humanitarian perspective, arguably the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world. It's at a really kind of pivotal piece of geography for the global economy, for the flows of people. It has potential to further destabilize politics in Europe because of the politics of refugees there. And yet, you mentioned Darfur. In my memory, there was a massive Save Darfur movement that kind of entered popular consciousness. You and I have crossed paths a lot over the years. You were in Congress, you were at the Center for American Progress, you were helping to lead the Open Societies Foundations. So you've done movement building in politics as well as policy. Why do you think there hasn't been the same kind of public awareness of this issue as we saw, say, with Darfur? And what would you say to people who are listening who want to do something? They want to get involved, or they want to donate, or they want to, have their voices heard. I mean, how do we generate more public awareness and mobilization around this?
I'll tell you, it's a great question, Ben. I've never been a part of a crisis of this scale that gets so little attention. And particularly when you contrast it to when I was in Darfur 20 years ago. And again, it was every campus, every celebrity, people were engaged and they should have been engaged. It was a horrific genocide happening and unfolding in front of our very eyes. And here we have a similar crisis. We've already had ethnic cleansing. We've had crimes against humanity. There are some who've reached the conclusion of genocide. And yet it is just almost total silence from the world community. And sure, you know, the racism of coverage of Africa or lack of coverage of Africa comes to mind. But we've had trouble even getting the African press to cover this. It doesn't seem to fit a neat narrative of good versus evil. I think, if I may say, for me, compared to my nieces and nephews, you know, our generation had a lot of interest in atrocity prevention, never again kind of mentality. And now I think the anti-imperialist, if the U.S. isn't the bad guy, it's a little less interesting. So there's some element of that. You know, it's a cultural issue, too, where it's an Arabic speaking country. There's always the question of, is it more Arab or African, the complexity of the conflict. And I think some just exhaustion and heartbreak with Sudan over the years. And then I think it comes to some of the solutions, which is people say, OK, what can we be for? And we have just lost the debate generationally on things like responsibility to protect or anything related to the idea that either the African Union or the United Nations would be prepared to intervene and be part of the solution. And we don't tend to want to see that through U.S. unilateralism. So there's a whole set of tools that are off the table. That being said, people can go to something like mutualaidsudan.org, which is one of the platforms that's supporting these emergency response rooms, which are Sudanese youth who've come up with these created cash apps and a Jose Andre type model of local kitchens. That was the call I was on where three of their volunteers died in 90 minutes. This is the real thin end of the spear kind of delivery of aid in some of the hardest hit areas. You know, there's certainly groups, Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and others that, you know, are continuing to try to push on arms embargo and other needs. But again, we just have not seen anything like the kind of response that you would imagine to the worst humanitarian crisis on Earth.
Yeah, well, look, I think those are good tips for how people can get involved. And I think just following this work and raising your own voices on it is really important. Tom, really appreciate all the work you and your team are doing. And thanks for walking us through so much in a relatively brief period of time here.
Well, thank you for giving Sudan some coverage. And thanks to President Biden and Secretary Blinken for, you know, giving us some room to lead on this.
Yeah. No, thanks, Tom.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks again to Tom Perriello for joining the show. And I think that's it for us.
That's it. And I think I'm out next week.
You're on vacation next week?
No, I'm
wait, is the week after?
Work travel. I'm gonna hopefully see our buddy David Lammy over in London.
Oh, nice.
And I'm like hopscotching for the Obama Foundation in Europe for a few days.
Excellent. We'll have fun with that.
Yeah.
If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. If you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Ilona Minkowski. Our associate producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick and engineered by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Phoebe Bradford, William Jones, Kirill Palaviv, and Molly Lobel, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld. If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.